Well, welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett, and today I'm joined with my colleague, Shane Tews, and we're going to discuss some of the issues that are in front of the FCC and Congress at the moment as a result of the election. Hello, Shane.
Hi, Richard. Happy 2017. Almost year of the rooster. I think that's this weekend.
Oh, it is. All right.
Chinese New Year, yeah.
Yeah, well, I have to have some Coco Van to celebrate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you should.
So a lot of things happening in Washington. We had an election. It didn't turn out the way the experts expected. We have a new FCC chairman who pretty much is the one who was expected after, at least after the election results were sorted out. So it looks like there's a lot of work ahead of the FCC, huh?
I think so. Chairman Pai had one of his first group speeches to his team yesterday and only had one issue that is his starting point, which was digital divide, which we can get into. But there's a lot on the plate and a lot of things that are looking to be revised from the last several years of the former FCC chairman. So, yes, it's going to be a very busy place, as is the rest of the administration.
Yeah. Yeah, digital divide's an interesting issue because this is one of the areas, I think, where a unanimous agreement on the part of, well, we right now we have three members of the FCC, the chairman and Mike O'Reilly, the Republican, and Mignon Clyburn, the Democrat. The three of them had reached a consensus position on what to do with lifeline funding in the previous FCC that was quite dramatically reversed at the last minute through some congressional pressure on Commissioner Clyburn. So it appears to me that one of the things that might be in the works, and this is just speculation, is a revival of that the lifeline reforms to accomplish the dual goals of providing some support for broadband access by low-income communities, but also a cap on the amount of spending that goes into Lifeline.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty sage way of collaborating. Obviously, this is something they've been discussing for a long time, and I think a lot of it's just a matter of cost and how exactly it gets paid for, and if we stay with status quo, or if we move to a new model.
Yeah, and this is the funding for universal service for either whether it's telephony or broadband, and it becomes especially acute in broadband. The funding of that through a tax on the broadband bills that urban residents pay has never really seemed to me like the most sensible way to go about it. It's a public policy priority, and ideally that the support for that would come out of the Treasury so that you don't have this bizarre situation where low-income urban broadband consumers are paying for the support of higher-income rural broadband consumers. But that's a tough lift for Congress, to completely change the financial basis of a large program like that.
Well, next time I see you, I'm going to bring both my broadband and my cellular bill, and you can see if you can figure out what any of those line items are for.
Oh, that's way over my head. Yeah, we'd have to get about 14 lawyers to explain that to us.
That's probably true.
Yeah, but yeah, I do see there's a lot of discussion going on Capitol Hill about rural broadband, improving the state of rural broadband, and it's I think Senator Thune hinted at that at the speech that he gave to the State of the Net conference early this week when he spent a really good portion of his speech talking about precision agriculture.
I was there. It really was. You know, people forget how much technology is used in agriculture and has really helped, especially in areas like, you know, when they're out there in the fields with combines and knowing, you know, just sort of the quantifiable information they can have at their fingertips and then making sure that they're using their equipment the most efficient way possible. That's a great, you know, help for the rural community. And I'm not sure how much broadband helps a tractor. I didn't listen to it that closely. But I do know that having, you know, the availability of Wi-Fi out there, almost all farm equipment now is got some cellular capability.
Yeah, I think it's becoming a cloud-based. Farming is becoming a cloud-based service. There's a lot of analytics involved in it because when it's not just harvesting, it's also fertilizing and watering. and applying pesticides, which is kind of a sensitive thing that you don't want to over apply, but if you under apply, then you know you lose your harvest. So, and making predictions about the weather is not really any easier now than it's ever been. And these are factors that farmers have to consider when they're running the precision ag equipment across the field and applying, you know, the correct dose of nutrients and liquids and pesticides to each individual quadrant of the field.
I actually read an article last week about how much money Gallo saved by predictive analysis and the way that they were watering their crops, and it was really significant. Don't have it at my fingertips, but I will share that with you eventually.
Yeah, and so this is an application in which better broadband would be very helpful. That if the tractor can communicate with the cloud while it's crossing the field. And this made some improvements in probably the stationary wireless or kind of semi-mobile wireless, because the combine's a slow-moving vehicle, where it'll help to have better broadband in rural areas. And there's not the same sort of financial dynamics to support it that exist out there as in the urban areas. But, you know, that's where our food comes from. So it's...
Right.
It is an issue of some importance to those of us who live in the cities.
People in urban areas do like to eat, and I am one of them.
Yeah.
So what do you think, on a different topic, net neutrality or the open internet order is certainly a hot topic around here in Washington. You know, kind of what's next? What happens?
It seems that there's sort of a carryover from the previous actions on, the open internet order, which may or may not be the same thing as net neutrality, depending on how picky you want to be about it. The press still doesn't understand the difference between Title II and open internet. The Larry Downs wrote a piece in Forbes about the fact that press accounts of Chairman Pai tend to characterize him as an enemy of net neutrality, which I don't think is the case. I mean, if we think about net neutrality in terms of the broad ideals that we want, you know, better, faster, cheaper broadband for everybody, he's not opposed to that. The question is partially how you characterize the goals and also what the means are. And he is certainly... Chairman Pai has never been bashful about the fact that he doesn't believe that Title II is the appropriate goal to achieve, or the appropriate tool to use to achieve the goal of making sure that the internet remains a vibrant, dynamic ecosystem that supports innovation.
I think he's not alone in that. And I do think we're going to see potential legislative action on this. I think that you're going to see Chairman Walden want to look at this from a legislative perspective, and that would have a much longer term value to how this moves forward. And I think that Pai he noted that previously in years past of, you know, we should really be looking at some legislative reform over doing this as, you know, part of an agency action.
Yeah, the law that the FCC operates under hasn't been modified substantially in 20 years. And even, I think a lot of people would argue that the 96 update to the Communications Act, which actually took about 10 years to pull off, was essentially obsolete by the time it passed. And it certainly had, I mean, there's like two mentions of the internet. And I think it's typically in relation to porn filters or something. I mean, there's not really a substantial attempt in the 96 update to characterize internet policy beyond sort of the general statement that it should be deregulatory, that the U.S. policy is to let 1,000 flowers bloom in the internet space and to keep a hands-off approach. But it's that hasn't been, you know, what we've seen in the last few years.
Well, especially since dial tone's really not a thing anymore. I think that looking at the legacy regulations and the items that are maybe no longer necessary because they just aren't how the system works is might be kind of first order of business, seeing what we can low-hanging fruit that we can take away. I do know that structural reform has been something that a lot of people have been looking at for, back even to the 96 Act. I mean, you always had a group that just thought that the FCC was not structured properly for the technology that was around then. And now now we definitely are looking at much more interesting ways that people communicate, and they don't go into the ways that the bureaus are looking at the old, very old legislation and laws that are on the books.
Well, and there's some things that the FCC can do on that independently of an act of Congress. I mean, in terms of the internal organization of the bureaus and what kind of marching orders essentially the bureaus have from the eighth floor. But in some sense, as long as the Communications Act is siloed, the FCC as an agency has to be siloed to a certain degree as well, I would think.
Well, I guess part of the process then is bringing more valued information into the process. I know there was a paper that came out. It was reported in Morning Consult about creating an economic bureau that does economic analysis and looking at proposed rules and other actions going forward. I was really surprised. This, not being somebody who spends a lot of time at the FCC as I do with the other agencies, that this was not something that was already there. The Federal Trade Commission has somewhere north of 70 economists within their, the teams that they work on, and I just was always surprised by that. So I'm hopeful to see that we'll see much more economic analysis out. I know that Commissioner O'Reilly has been very vocal about that.
Well, and the famous phrase, the FCC's and the open internet order was an economics free zone that Tim Brennan, and he kind of wishes he hadn't said it because he gets quoted for it so widely, and he was sort of making a joke, but it's like a lot of jokes, it was more true than many things that aren't really meant to be funny.
I think it's the kernel of truth that makes it funny.
And it certainly is true that at a high level, the difference between the FCC and the FTC is that the FTC is an economics bureau, I mean, agency across the board, which is, I think, why a lot of the critics of the FCC structure have proposed shifting functions out of the FCC into the Federal Trade Commission, because that one way that they know for sure they're going to get some economic analysis, where economics and technology, which is kind of my hot button. I'd like to see an FCC that is a lot more sensitive to both the technical and the economic aspects of the policies it enacts, rather than, having all these lawyers who just sit around thinking about clever ways to accomplish what they want to do, regardless of the law.
Right. Well, I think that we're going to have a lot of opportunity there with IoT, the Internet of Things. I think you and I've discussed this before in previous podcasts as a general topic, but how those get created and move forward, as we have lots and lots of chatty little items that are going to be around, and if we are able to do security by design in there, really does lay at the Federal Trade Commission, because it's going to be, if you have a harm element on the going forward, that will hopefully help guide people to doing the right thing in the beginning. I'm not sure how the FCC, even though the most recent crew was always looking for things to tether onto. I other than the fact that they were using, a measure of communications for these to interact with each other, I never quite understood how IoT was in their bailiwick.
Well, and this is a question that a lot of people have raised, because the FTC is the general regulator of the entire economy, and the FTC has expertise in privacy and also in cybersecurity. And the FTC has actually been the leader among the federal agencies in cybersecurity, although NTIA is involved in it as well, and of course DHS and FBI and whoever. But this is an area of very significant overlap between the FCC and the Federal Trade Commission. And it seems to me that the FTC's background and approach and expertise exceeds that of the FCC. We continue to, there's sort of some carryover of cybersecurity plans that came out of the FCC, basically carryover from the Wheeler FCC, that really aren't that great. Didn't you write a blog post about that today?
I did. It's up on techpolicydaily.com today, and it's talking about the flawed arguments for cybersecurity that were proposed in very last-minute regulation thoughts in a white paper that was put out last week. And the challenge there is they were asking any they're very much focusing on ISPs, and the premise was that ISPs do not have a market interest in creating security in their systems because it would benefit their their other colleagues in the market. And that just doesn't make any sense to me because, as you know much better than I, the way that the networks operate is a network of networks, and everyone needs to have the strongest network possible to make sure that everything is getting passed back and forth. That these networks are doing a handshake constantly, the zeros and ones, the level of protection that is in the system. Somebody having very low criteria cybersecurity harms all. And so I note that in the piece, but one of the things that I don't go that in depth with because of the audience in this on Tech Policy Daily, but I'm always fascinated with how engineers feel very protective, especially of the internet and the way that they work with the IAB and the IETF and other groups like that. That
NANOG.
yes, yeah. So the peer-to-peer protection is one of those things that I hope we never take for granted, but I know is very strong.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that whoever wrote that white paper at the FCC hasn't spent very much time among the kind of people who are responsible for cybersecurity in the different, not just the ISPs, but the transit networks. They have organizations like the North American Network Operators Group, NANOG, that meets, I think, 3 times a year face to face, so that the principal players in network security and network stability in all the different networks get to know each other on a face-to-face basis and develop relationships of trust. And they call on each other when they have issues, when they have certain kinds of attacks. And they count on the fact that if I can ask my buddies for help when my network is under attack, then it's they're going to ask me for help when their networks are under attack, and we're all going to solve the problem together. I mean, this is certainly the case when there was an issue with Pakistan trying to shut down Skype, right? And the way they did it was they made some changes to the BGP routing tables that essentially caused most of the Skype traffic in the world to route through China.
And just so our BGP is the Border Gateway Protocol.
Yeah, it's the thing that internet routers use to advertise the reachability of different endpoints. And so Pakistan took like a whole large block of IP, and Skype uses more than one IP. I mean, no, it was YouTube. YouTube uses more than one IP address, so they essentially advertised that they could route efficiently to a whole, basically the entire set of YouTube servers. And because Pakistan got its internet service through an ISP in China, all the YouTube traffic started to go through China. And the people who solved that, the YouTube people, and there were engineers at Yahoo that were involved in it that weren't even involved in making the fix, who weren't even directly implicated. But it's because they had these trust relationships, because they knew each other and had cooperated with each other on, security issues in the past. That's really the way that the internet would not function at all without a high degree of collaboration on the part of the engineers.
So it's sort of the engineering version of a volunteer fire department. They all come running to the cause.
Yeah,
One of
exactly. It's a great analogy. It's
the many
certainly is
reasons why
like
we
that.
love you guys.
And the people that do the actual work, the people that are in the rooms with the spinning fans and all the routers, when they're under attack, they don't really care, like what's on their business card. So it becomes a it's a community effort to resolve these problems, and always has been. And it's just shocking. I'm sure the FTC understands this because they've had so many workshops on cybersecurity, in which people have come in and explained to them, how they deal with attacks, and that they wouldn't make such a naive claim that this is fundamentally driven by economic incentives.
Yeah, it's an interesting read if you have some time you don't know what to do with. But I think the conclusion is that, this is an area, as you've just talked about the engineers. These are not just people that are in the communication sector. They're within the technology sector. We have people in the utility sector. We're seeing more and more of this in, automobiles and transportation, and it's all about the the coding and the, you know, how we're managing the challenges that may come in, you know, through a denial of service attack or a bot attack or malware. There and so as much as they're a little, they're not loved, but they're becoming better. We're certainly seeing the Department of Homeland Security to be the place from a national perspective on how we manage this. I know we have gone through iterations of how to manage information sharing going forward. I think thanks to the Russians, we're starting to see that, you know, that managing cybersecurity is no longer a luxury. It is a necessity of how everybody does business, because we've all really latched on to this, you know, digital medium and the digital economy and all the great things it brings with it. And for that to continue, we need to make sure that we're securing the networks, from the beginning to the end. And that doesn't matter where you sit on the network. We want to make sure that they're secured at every level.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of situations, network security, well, a long time ago, it was sort of an afterthought and primary concern when, you know, when you're on a network with a trusted population is, you know, you want it to be fast and reliable. But there aren't very many networks that are like that anymore. Certainly, if you're part of the internet, you're not always part of a trusted community. So your job one is really keeping the network as safe from threats as and attacks as possible.
Yeah, so that seems to be that it's everyone's job. You
Yeah.
can't lay it at the ground of your ISP or maybe just your enterprise carrier. You know, you've got to make sure that your partners that you're working with, and as we've seen in most of the data attacks or the data leakage over the last couple of years, they were the third-party vendors who didn't realize that a lack of security in their system was going to be the wormhole that somebody was going to be able to access something like JP Morgan, Target, Home Depot. And that was an expensive lesson for everyone to learn. But hopefully a lot of major corporations and small and medium-sized businesses are taking that to heart.
Well, you know, even in the net neutrality discourse before it became simply a matter of demonizing ISPs, was there was a recognition that the internet has this quirky end-to-end architecture in which most of the control over what happens on the internet is actually in the end system. It's in the laptops and the phones and the PCs and the servers that are connected to the internet. And at the end of the day, there's actually a limited amount of protection that the networks can provide to the end users. I mean, if we're going to open email attachments that install viruses on our computers, the ISPs can't very well prevent us from doing that. I
That's
mean,
a very good point. They
you
don't
know?
always know what's in those. The most of the times, they don't know what's in those packets, and so we're in an awkward situation asking them to take those packets off the network when they, in theory, should not have any idea what is in those packets.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are encrypted.
Yeah, and so I mean the inconsistencies between saying that we need net neutrality to preserve the end-to-end architecture of the internet, and we don't want ISPs looking at our personal, you know, web browsing information. When we say that those two things on the one hand, then the other, you know, we say we want the ISPs to keep us safe from attacks. It just does not compute. There's
Right.
no consistency.
So is this going to get better or worse with 5G?
I think well, eventually we get to the breaking point where we need to have a more rational structure for communications policy and law. And right now, one of the things that came out during the Wilbur Ross confirmation hearing, with the people were asking about, oddly, about repurposing government spectrum. And he pointed out that there are about 17 different agencies that are involved that, you know, where you have to get buy-in from in order to repurpose some government spectrum. And so with the pressure on the policy apparatus that new technologies always create, I think gets heightened by 5G, and which will cause us to rationalize the overall structure of how we manage spectrum across both the public sector and the private sector, and the need for consistency in communication law. And actually, a need for greater technical expertise and economic expertise in the federal government, in the executive branch, in order to be able to implement the new policy frameworks that we're going to have to develop.
That's a big wish, which I think there's quite a few people who, you know, realize that when again, legacy, when those things were created, they were done in these little silos where they didn't realize that making spectrum work in these pockets was eventually going to be a major flaw. in how it's orchestrated. So with a lot of new eyes on these problems, I hope that that will be one of the net positive outcomes. We'll see a restructuring of this.
Yeah,
So
I mean, we
expect.
haven't really fully digested the significance of the internet, I think, from a policy perspective, because when the Communications Act was devised and throughout really most of history until about 1980, the practice with network engineering was that you designed a network to support one and only one application. So if you wanted to have phone calls, you built a network that could handle phone calls. If you wanted to have telegrams, you built a network that could handle telegrams. Same thing goes with cable TV and mobile phones and so many other things. But the internet is the first network that we've had of a broad scope in which one network could do more than one thing. And so we used to assign spectrum the same way. If you had an application that needed spectrum, then you'd go to the FCC, you get a spectrum assignment, and you're good to go. And when that happens, after that's happened about 10,000 times, and then you start to see some progress and some technology improvements in those different apps, it becomes more sensible to treat the spectrum that's used by these different applications as a common pool. And we can get a whole lot more utility out of it that way. And so we get spectrum licensing and auctions as a way to make that happen. And it's fortunate that we don't have to use one band of spectrum to make a mobile phone call and another band to send a text message and another band to access the internet. But if we followed the logic of the old assignment system, that's actually what we'd be doing.
Yeah, that's one of those. If you were to map it out today, it doesn't make any sense without knowing the history of it. That's for sure. So, a couple thoughts. Wondering going forward, do you think set-top box? Are we done with that issue? Speaking of other things that were legacy carriers on how we use the networks.
Yeah, I think we are done with the set-top box proceeding is just not going to advance. What's actually happening is that the MVPDs are working with the manufacturers of the streaming boxes, the Rokus and the Apple TVs and the Amazon Fires, to ensure that they can get the capability to view live television programming in those boxes without all the rigmarole of the set-top box order. And the issue, but the technical thing behind that is that we don't really have a coherent technical standard where we can just say, like, everybody that runs an MVPD service or everyone that has a video streaming box that wants to stream should conform to standard XYZ about how to do that. So the industry actually has to develop the standard. And once we have a coherent standard, then it might be appropriate at that point for the FCC to start talking about making it a mandate. But my suspicion is that once we know how to do this from a standards perspective, it's in the interest of all the players to go ahead and adopt that common standard and just do it that way. So we need to do probably another 2 or 3 years worth of experimentation to figure out what the best way, technical way is to approach the problem. And when we have that, I think the problem of getting more video to more devices will solve itself.
So I know you don't use a box. How are you getting your sports and anything that you want to watch these days?
I have cable card devices.
Oh.
And so to me, this set-top box thing, what it went off track because the original, what Congress actually asked the FCC to do was to come up with a new standard that did what the old cable card system used to do. And instead of answering that call from Congress, the FCC kind of went off and did some speculative stuff that, the answer is actually it can't be done right now. So there's work being done in the technical community that's going to make it easy, but we can't really force that to a conclusion.
Well, it's certainly going to get more interesting as more and more people are creating content and finding other ways to watch it. And we're seeing a lot more short form as well as quite a bit of long form has been coming out recently. You see more and more shows that people won't talk about that are a good hour long, and there's 10 or 12 of them to see a season.
Yeah, I mean, and Netflix keeps producing all this original programming. They found a new revenue stream for it, product placements. There are probably up to 50 product placements an hour in the new original programming that Netflix is producing, which obviates the need for commercials.
I have not been paying enough attention. Either that or I'm subliminally starting to buy new things. I'm not sure.
You probably are, yeah. Yeah, combine all that. And I think this is the reason that Amazon wants to be in the video streaming business. There's sort of a direct synergy between those product placements and the shows and, you know, the basic business of Amazon, which is retail.
Yeah, I still don't understand the buttons. Maybe I just don't buy enough dishwashing detergent to want a button in my kitchen that tells me to go do that. I bought an Amazon Dot, and I just don't talk to it. So hence, it's kind of worthless for me. But I know that people love it.
Yeah, I've got a Dot on one floor of the house and an Echo on the other, and I actually do use them to turn the lights on and off. That's about all I do with them, though. But there are other things they could do.
That seems to be a favorite application. I hear from a lot of people who say they like to set up their children's room so their children can tell Alexa to turn off the lights.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alexa, get the monsters out of my room.
But I was very, very surprised. Yeah, exactly. That might work. When I was at the Consumer Electronics Show, Alexa-enabled devices were all the rage. I mean, they were on watches. It was on, you know, a version of a tablet or, a Surface that was all, you know, I asked what they were using, and they said it was Alexa-driven. You can talk to it. So you no longer need the Echo or the Dot. And the next generation we're going to see come out, you know, this summer and fall are all going to be items that are going to have a platform designed into them. And you can talk to it, but it doesn't have to be just the circular item that you have in your kitchen or your the second floor of your house right now.
Oh, that's cool. But when something achieves dominance of consumer electronics, does that mean that it's really the hot thing or that it's already over?
Well, in this case, I think it's interesting that I know when I went to CES 2 years ago, it seemed like there were, especially the automobile companies, were aligning with either an Android system or an Apple device system.
Right.
I mean, for a long time, Microsoft was aligned with Ford, and now Ford has gone over to Alexa. And so now it's not so much, I can have the Alexa app on whatever my smartphone device is, and it doesn't have to be specific to either an Android or an Apple-based system. So it's interesting, I think, that it leaped over that in 2 years. They realized that was probably a lot of, a lot of partnerships that may not come out right in the end, and Alexa's showing them an interesting way to get around that.
So they're kind of playing the role of Switzerland, so it's... You don't have to be committed to a particular telephone, to Android or iOS. You can just have Alexa, and then it's universal.
Right. I'm not sure if I'm ready to no longer drive. That seemed to be the next big thing out there in the electronic, you know, land, and a lot of hardware and software devices. I know a lot of money's being spent on it, but maybe it's my Midwestern roots. I still like to drive my car.
Well, the first time I heard about cars that would do auto braking to prevent collisions, I thought that was the craziest thing in the whole world. I'd never want that. But
right.
I have a car that does that, and I really like the feature. It's probably saved me from having at least a couple of near collisions, if not actual wrecks. So I think we can, you know, we get used to these things once we realize that there's some benefits.
We'll adapt. Yes. Once we start really seeing it in the urban areas, I mean, it makes sense that you can test these things in Arizona. In the far, you know, deserts, but we'll see when it starts going to Boston and New York and Washington and San Francisco and Denver.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of going on a road trip, and especially driving through the mountains, and when the other people in the car are saying, "Oh man, look at that! Isn't that great?" You know, you can't take your eyes off the road and look at it. It'd be nice to be able to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. If we get to a point where we trust it going over Independence Pass, that will be a whole new day.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on that. I had all of my navigation, all of my electronics in my Subaru went out the last time I went over Independence Pass, and I had to drive home with multiple flashing lights. And I mean, it turns out there was actually nothing wrong with the car. It was just sort of a software glitch where it but you'd think a Subaru would be tested going across Independence Pass. I mean, it's pretty much what most of the vehicles are making that trip. So I haven't quite figured that out.
There are a lot of them. Well, I'm glad that you got home okay.
Yeah, the state car of Colorado.
Right.
All right. So Anything else? I think if
I
not.
think we got a lot on our plate for the beginning of the year, and it's going to be interesting. Let's stay tuned and see what happens.
I think it's probably a lot more active than things would be right now if the election turned out the other way. I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but it's definitely reality.
We'll never know.
All right, Shane.
Thanks,
So,
Frederick.
folks, that wraps up this edition of the High Tech Forum podcast. Check back in with the hightechforum.org website for new podcasts. And if you heard this on iTunes and meet your standards, then write us up a little review. And so, once again, I'm Richard Bennett, signing off.